That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
We're in a business, ladies and gentlemen, a business of satisfying the hunger of the public for thrills, escape, and news.
I don't want any more economists, sages, or oracles bombinating over our cables. I want a reporter.
No more bombinating. We have a room full of reporters here. C.R. Douglas of KCPQ, Channel 13. I will give you some water.
Thank you.
Eli Sanders, we thank your mother for pledging her support last week on the air, even though she's not supposed to have told you that she did that. And Knut Berger, our friend Skip, he comes in because he cares so much about this pledge drive, even though his back is hurting. That shows the dedication to public radio that we expect from all of you. I am sorry if some of you are in the hospital right now on your lips or what, you know, whatever that would be. I didn't want to say on your death.
Real hard to pledge.
I know. It's making it hard to pledge. If Skip could come in when his back hurts, you could pledge your support to public radio.
On the way in here, I also pledged.
Just so we wouldn't give you a bad time.
No, because it took away a little bit of the pain, Steve.
Really?
It feels that
good.
It feels that good.
That might be next year's spot.
Talk your pain away.
All right. Well, here. All right. Now I'm going to make a terrible segue, if I may, into talking the pain away. The judge yesterday, who is in charge of looking over on our SPD reform efforts, was stern. He was not happy. He was saying, this is taking too long. You guys cannot drag your feet. We could be here till 2019 if you don't get it together, and you got to get it together now. Not soon, not in a while, but right now. Pretty tough talk.
Very tough talk. And it wasn't just the judge pointing that out. The Federal Monitor also pointed it out this week, and the U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkan pointed it out. I mean, all three are giving critiques that are suggesting the problem is much worse than most of us even thought, and that this new mayor, who they all seem to have hope for, needs to kind of get this house in order. I think there's a little bit of a dig at Mayor McGinn in sort of what all those folks said, kind of reminding people that a lot of things didn't happen by the end of last year that were supposed to, certainly under McGinn's watch. So little dig at McGinn, but a clear message to Ed Murray: you own this department. It's now yours. You got to make some progress.
Well, Steve Miletich ended his argument in Seattle Times this morning. We've been tracking it with him by quoting Ed Murray saying, yeah, it's mine now. I'm in charge of this. Ed Murray, one of the things they said, glitches in recording off patrol car video and audio. There hasn't been a standardization for collecting data. Then there hasn't been a clear plan to properly train sergeants who are supposed to provide supervision and oversight to officers. And overarching that criticism, Merrick Bob made it, was that for such a high-tech city, you guys are a few decades behind. What did you make of what we heard this week, Eli?
I'm glad to hear Mayor Murray say that he owns it now and really take responsibility for it, because he's been running out of road on the kind of grace period that you would get coming in as a new mayor and inheriting this department that everyone admits has a lot of problems. So that's good to hear. We need to hear pretty soon about a police chief selection process going forward, because I believe that was on the list of the many things that he was going to get to in April, along with $15 an hour and more. So looking forward to that and to some clarity beyond what happened, weeks ago when we were dealing with the issue of police discipline, and Mayor Murray stood by the person that he's brought in to run the department, who is now, I think, showing himself definitely not to be a reformer. Mayor Murray stood by him and said, I'm going to, stand with his decisions on basically reversing these punishments. But at the same time, I know that the punishment and review process is very flawed. Okay, fix it.
You pointed out, Knut, in that Crosscut had a great article that was a Bill Stang's article.
Bill Lucian.
Bill Lucian's article, Johnston, yeah. This long article looking at, by sort of like point by point, how things have unfolded. They were in the weeds on that article, but when we get into the weeds, we see it's a kind of a confused process.
It is a kind of a confused process, and Ann Levinson has a report out today suggesting, going in detail.
The OPA auditor, the Office of the Economy Auditor.
That's right, the OPA auditor, retired judge, who has been outlining reforms to the process. She's the person who kind of most intimately knows and has studied the process and whether it works. She has a critique today of both how that process works and some of the things that need to be changed that led to some of the issues that came up during the disciplinary when Interim Chief Harry Bailey reversed decisions on half a dozen or so discipline cases. And I had a chance just to go through it, but it points to a couple of really interesting issues. One is that the process of following up on citizen complaints and whatnot, it can be improved, but it's not particularly confusing. What's confusing is there are all these multiple avenues to appeal any final decision that's made. And that they can go to an arbiter.
The cops have that right.
That's right. Yeah. The citizens don't have a right to appeal the decision, but the police do. And they can do it through union grievances. There are kind of a couple of avenues there. They can go before a civil service board. They can go against to a complaint board. And so not only are these all these different ways, but all of these things are poorly documented. And this gets back to part of the technological issue, is that they don't track the complaints and the process and the decisions and then what happens to them in any way that anybody can access. And in fact, she pointed out that the mayor's numbers about the number of cases differs from the number of cases she's been able to track by going into the detail of all the paperwork. So the OPA auditor and the mayor's office can't even agree on the number of complaints that have been dealt with, let alone which have been overturned, why they've been overturned. It's a mess. And you can only suspect it's a mess for a couple of reasons. One is budgets and, you know, transferring to new sophisticated. And the other is that somebody wanted it to be a mess. It's almost by design to be so complicated with so many exits.
Bureaucracies don't do that.
Bureaucracies don't do that. Unions would never do that, right? Civil servants would never find a way to protect themselves. And it does need reform, and it's becoming clearer and clearer when you get into the weeds that it's really a mess.
All right, let me come back to that in a few moments, but let me just say that C.R. Douglas is here, Eli Sanders here, Knute Berger's here. This is The Week in Review. Week in Review is C.R. Douglas, KCPQ, Q13 news commentator and analyst, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger and Pulitzer Prize winner, Knute Berger, author of Pugetopolis, History of the Space Needle, and writes at Crosscut as the Mossback, Seattle Magazine as well. There was an interesting statement that Judge Robart made when he was talking about his concerns about implementing SPD reform yesterday. He commented on the controversy over the charges and disciplinary rulings that embroiled Mayor Ed Murray and Interim Police Chief Harry Bailey, like we were talking about. He said he wouldn't revisit the past decisions, but held the right to unilaterally change results he deemed unconstitutional. That he's sort of taken it to a whole nother level with that statement.
Yeah, that was a big statement, presuming that he would intervene and, you know, reverse a chief decision on these discipline cases in the future. That's how I read it, which would be unprecedented. About the investigation and sort of accountability process for police misconduct, I mean, all kinds of reforms need to happen. Skip talked about the OPA auditor and the things she's recommended. But it ultimately also relies on the goodwill and the leadership of the chief. Any of these systems has some chief discretion in them, and they could sort of tamper with or, you know, uphold the trust of the system. And I think what we saw in Harry Bailey in these recent misconduct cases was a sort of, you know, mischief with the system. He overturned police misconduct findings that the OPA investigation had delivered and did it in a way that was, I don't want to say dishonest, but were not true, claimed that the former chief was the one that gave him the leadership and the reason to do it, that he approved him. He was just sort of seconding that. Yeah. That turned out not to be the case. It was the biggest misstep of the Murray administration so far in its 3 months. I think this chief has kind of done damage to Ed Murray's credibility on police reform. It was one of the biggest issues in the campaign. He made a lot of headway in that, and I thought had a pretty effective narrative on that in the campaign. And the number of things this chief has done has really damaged that. So in retrospect, I don't think hiring this police chief on the interim has been a good move by Ed Murray.
Do you agree with that? We had talked about this on Wednesday a little bit too. Do you think Ed Murray's wounded by this, Eli?
Absolutely. And it's a self-inflicted wound because he chose Harry Bailey and promoted him as a interim change agent. And because it leaves this festering question that can probably never be answered, but is a very good question that a lot of people are asking, which is, did Ed Murray, in exchange for the endorsement of the police union in the election, which he really wanted and which helped him against McGinn, did he promise to put a police union official, maybe specifically Harry Bailey, in as police chief to take care of their own and restore the ancient regime for at least, you know, an interim period so that they could protect some people until a new police chief came in, or even move someone like Harry Bailey into the role of new police chief? If so, what a short-sighted decision by Murray.
You know, it's interesting. Jenny Durkin was kind of, the U.S. attorney was kind of walking back the cat a little bit on her criticism of the administration yesterday by saying, you know, we are getting reform going. There have been some glitches, but it sounded like she was sort of trying to give Murray some props for where he's gone. But do you think he's irreparably wounded at this point?
Irreparably? No, I wouldn't say that. It certainly, as CR said, it raises the stakes about the chief. But I think as the report came out, this isn't about a chief. I mean, that's an important step. You got to get the right person in there. But this is about things that can't wait for a new chief. This is about cultural change. And I think the Harry Bailey move, I mean, you know, you can debate like where he is, but certainly the result of this disciplinary brouhaha is the fact that he did not come off as a reformer, and the fact remains that Ed Murray, when asked at Civic Cocktail right before this disciplinary thing blew up, was asked, what kind of police chief do you want? He said, I want somebody like Harry Bailey. This is my guy. I want somebody like this guy. Well, there are questions raised about this guy. And the mayor is not the only person who's going to be picking the next chief. But, you know, you cannot – it goes to the issue of judgment. And now you've ratcheted up the stakes and – we have to see how that plays out. I don't doubt Ed Murray's commitment to the idea of reform. I think he genuinely wants it, and I think he wants the right thing. The question is whether he can get us there. That's partly why he was elected mayor.
All right, I'm going to move on from that issue. There's a lot to talk about. We won't be letting it go. I just wanted to get your guys' thought on the Supreme Court ruling, McCutcheon ruling, that says big donors though still limited for now at $5,200 per campaign, can spread that money out as far and wide as they want. So somebody did the math the other day on how much that money might be for congressional and Senate campaigns, and it comes about $3 million, a big donor. So did money just start buying? This all goes to the question of whether money buys influence, but did money just start buying a little more influence with this ruling?
No, I don't believe so. I think it changed where money is going to go, but it didn't probably change the aggregate amount that's in elections now. Listen, we have two limits on contributions at the federal level. One is, as you say, the amount you can give to an individual candidate. And that happens to be $5,200, and it's sort of a two-year cycle, which are election cycles. So that's been your limit. And in any one candidate, that's all you can give. And then there was a sort of overall limit, which was $48,000. So you can give $5,200 to as many candidates as you want until you get to $48,000. That is your overall limit for how much you can give to federal candidates in any election cycle. What the Supreme Court did was knocked out that second limit, the $48,000. So you can still only give $5,200 per candidate, but you can now effectively give to an unlimited number of candidates. So whereas before, you sort of, if you maxed out, that was kind of nine candidates. It's about all you could fund if you wanted to do the max.
Directly.
Now you could directly. Now you can basically give to all 435 members of Congress, you know, who are running. I mean, that's so that's the limit that was thrown out. I think a lot of this money was going to these super PACs and these independent expenditures anyway. So actually, it's going to bring money, I think, mostly back into a more transparent regime, a more accountable regime where it can be tracked better. And I think it's going to be – it's a dollar spent directly on a candidate, I think, is a more accountable dollar than the sort of soft money we've seen.
Wow, you are a positive – that is a positive spin on that, CR. I was thinking about all the candidates that trooped over to Las Vegas to talk to that the magnate Sheldon, I always say his last name wrong,
Adelson.
Because
he's the guy with the super PAC.
He's got the super PAC.
He's got all this unlimited.
But there's no limit on that.
There's no limit on that.
Well, not a lot of limits on that. So you,
and less accountability.
You know, Clarence Thomas also said in his written finding that he doesn't see why there should be any limits. And I heard Emily Bazelon arguing that, well, that's probably next year. That'll be the next step, that they'll knock down those limits as well.
Meaning the $5,200 per candidate that still is in place.
Or, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That is the fear in this ruling, which comes on the heel of Citizens United, which also struck down campaign finance rules, that where does this stop? Justice Breyer said in his dissent that this ruling on its own eviscerates the campaign finance system that we had, the restrictions that were meant to preserve democracy, essentially. And so if this ruling eviscerates that, and it's just the first step under its own reasoning in knocking down all kinds of other campaign finance reforms, then what do we have when we have a system that's beyond eviscerated? And if the lifting of these limits allows one very wealthy person to contribute a certain amount to every member of Congress, how is that representative democracy? That is not what was envisioned when we created a Congress.
What do you think? Well, there's the numbers. Prior to the McCutcheon ruling, an individual could give $123,200 in a single election cycle, $48,600 to candidates, or, you know, maxing out at 18, this math says, and 74 to federal party committees. That limit is now gone. Money is speech and just.
Yeah, well, that's the problem.
Get loud.
It's not.
They're
wrong.
They said it was.
The Supreme Court says corporations are people, except they have more rights than people. And they say money and speech are the same thing. They're wrong. And we need a new Supreme Court. I mean, that. And that's something you can't just get by snapping your fingers. The thing that I think the thing that's sad about this whole thing, and also I don't know if it's not really ironic, maybe it is that when the Soviet Union fell, we said, well, they're going to become more like us. You know, they're going to become, you know, free markets and freedom, all that good stuff. In fact, the United States has become more like Russia – oligarchs, and a national security state. And it's all connected. And I know I'm sounding like a tinfoil guy here. but the fact is, we're meeting in the middle. You know, the Russians have gotten more capitalistic, and we're moving over to the brand of capitalism that they've embraced, which is the rich rule.
There's no drones flying over you, though, Skip.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, Amazon will solve that.
And we're waiting to hear from Inslee on that, but, as far as the state.
You know, I think this decision is a big deal because of the, I wouldn't even call it a slippery slope, but because of, as you guys have outlined, I mean, the where the court is clearly taking things. And I think few rational people would argue that more money in politics is a good thing. Certainly in a place like Seattle, you're already seeing pushback from Mike O'Brien had a press release out this week, you know, calling for public financing of campaigns in Seattle. It failed at the ballot this last time, but not by much. Could probably pass again in another environment. So you're seeing ways people locally are responding and in ways to trying to counteract this. But I couldn't see it as anything but good news.
I was thinking that it might be good news for state parties, and that's what people are saying too, because state parties were sort of cut out from some of the soft money. Now under this, what do they get? They could get a lot of money funneled through to their candidates, to them. So it could strengthen state party control.
I mean, one thing that Citizens United, that the case of a couple years ago, did was it weakened parties. I mean, it basically took money out of the party system and into all these kind of independent, single person, single issue PACs. And one thing that this will do by eliminating, again, not just the amount you can give overall to candidates, but to parties, both at the state and national level, is you'll see more money coming back to parties. They will kind of regain some of the strength they lost in the sort of Citizens United world. And to sort of complete what I was saying before, I think a dollar to a party is a better, more accountable dollar in politics than a dollar to a super PAC of Sheldon Adelson. I mean, parties are not perfect, but parties are trying to grow electorates. They're trying to have, you know, broader coalitions. They're trying to build movements. They've got accountability. The money is a lot more tracked.
But you do agree it brings more money in overall, doesn't it?
It brings more money, and it's a coalition looking at a farther future, building majorities, not a one-time super PAC set up, you know, in spring of an election year to funnel $35 million to some one person.
All right. It's a question of whether we fear the money and whether money speaks. This is the Week in Review. All right, I'm going to shift gears on you guys. And I know it's weird to shift gears, but that's what happens. Let's just touch a little bit on what has happened in Oso 2 weeks since the landslide. There's been a lot of attention to a 2005 clear cut that crossed into a little bit into the no harvest area, edge of a triangle in the area around Oso, up above the town and across the river. Washington's land commissioner Peter Goldmark told our Austin Jenkins that it's too early to guess what might have caused the slide.
Frankly, the results of a small timber harvest that occurred in 2005, and the small timber harvest was about 7 acres, and whether or not that had any role in creating the slide is entirely speculative at this time.
So we won't. What we are looking at is more people are coming in from the federal government, FEMA, other assistance to relieve the volunteers. Volunteers, as we are sure, are very tired, and now a new group of people are coming in to help them. We have rain that's going to be falling, that they expected more rain, but, you know, the weather's going to change, so people will be able to get in there. I guess at this point, we're at this strange part in a tragedy where people are reflecting. They're gathering themselves. They're seeing, well, what's next? And we're not pointing fingers yet. We're not looking at what happened, but a lot of people are waiting to understand what happened, and there's lots of reports, there's lots of things they're dealing with at this point. That's how it's unfolding, and I guess from you guys, it's the same thing. How is it unfolding now, this next week, as we look at this?
I think that's right. I mean, I think as you know, more bodies get recovered and sort of the dead are put to final rest, we are going to transition, you know, pretty clearly to how could this have happened. Some of that's been talked about already, the logging, etc. But there are a lot of places to turn. I mean, it's not just logging, but there have been a lot of reports over the years about the vulnerability of that hill, even whether it was logged or not. I mean, it does not take rock science, so to speak, to have understood that if you just look at the past history of that very hill, which slid a number of times over the course of several decades. So everyone kind of knew it was vulnerable. That's going to be looked at even harder. What's becoming clear is that no one seemed to think, or at least no one seriously thought, this big a slide would happen, even though they all felt some kind of slide was happening. And it seems as though the big fear was not that a town would be buried, but that the hill might come down and kind of block the river and flood the area, not necessarily threatening life, but threatening homes. And that was kind of the working fear, was a really bad flood, not a full-on burial.
What I found interesting was look at the tribes looking at this and their own geologists and biologists looking at it, because they're also concerned about fish runs and fish populations. They were also afraid of what was happening as the river was working into the toe of that. Any thoughts you have on this, Eli?
Well, I read in the Seattle Times this week that the state was considering moving all of the people out of that area at one point. So clearly it's not too soon to speculate that, you know, there should have been more concern and more analysis of what was going on with the hill and what was making it vulnerable, because the state saw enough at a certain point to be concerned enough to craft this proposal to move people out. And then it didn't follow up on that plan.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about historically. I mean, what, we had landslides that blocked the trains again this week. We've had slides and concerns about slides around the state. I mean, we are in a slide-prone area, and it just makes you want to ask questions about what's happening with the hillside above your house.
Well, it's, you know, I think people, depending on where you are with this disaster, you're going through it in different phases. And obviously the people closest to Arlington and Oso and people in Snohomish County are still going through a grief process at this point. There's still bodies being identified, missing people. And so the tragedy is very real. And those of us in the outer circle begin to ask the larger policy questions. It's kind of reminds me of like an airline disaster, in the sense that the cause is often complicated, more than one factor that contribute. You know, it's rare that a airline crashes and there's only one thing. So putting the picture pieces together after the fact here is going to be really important, because you want to try and prevent this from ever happening again anywhere. Now, you can't prevent landslides or mudslides entirely, but you can do things to make sure that people aren't harmed by them when they happen, or that you do everything in your power. And so the importance of needing to know what happened and why is crucial. It will also come up in, I'm sure, what will be inevitable litigation that comes up as a result. And so it'll begin to enter a political sphere. Who knew what when, who acted, who didn't, who... And, you know, I mean, Peter Goldmark, the lands commissioner, of course, doesn't really want to talk about the logging piece of the puzzle because he says it's speculative. Well, everything is speculative at this point, except that the mudslide happened and killed a bunch of people.
Well, and his agency is...
And his agency is sort of...
They give permits for logging.
Yeah.
They give permits for logging. And he is, you know, has been dodging the press until he talked to Austin. So, you know, he's going to be on the hot seat. But he's also correct. We don't know precisely what happened here, and it's going to be really important to get that picture.
Just briefly, yeah, you know, whether logging did or didn't contribute it, we don't know. Maybe that's what you can do to help in the future. Otherwise, you can't stop the rain. You can't stop geology. It's pretty tough to maybe absent logging as a factor, figure out how to prevent these. What you can do, and Eli talked about it, was there was this consideration to buy out people. I mean, to the extent that that was considered a vulnerable area, they did think about it, ultimately decided instead to kind of shore up the river and do some other stuff instead. But King County has a very aggressive buyout program, and they spent millions on four different sort of river watersheds buying up properties in vulnerable areas. And Snohomish County actually has done that too, to a lesser degree. They don't have much money, but they have bought out in certain areas. They chose not to do it in Oso, but this is going to reignite the sort of, have we bought out enough places? Is there enough money in that pot going forward?
Yeah. All right. Let me shift just real quick to Obamacare. I just want to touch on that because President Obama's Affordable Care Act, the significant piece of legislation, major backup this week. Real people signed up for health insurance under the law. President Obama spoke about it Tuesday. One of these, he also talked about the political battle that has raged since this began.
Fixing what's broken is hard. Overcoming skepticism and fear of something new is hard. A lot of times folks would prefer the devil they know to the devil they don't. But this law is doing what it's supposed to do. It's working. It's helping people from coast to coast. All of which makes the links to which critics have gone to scare people or undermine the law or try to repeal the law without offering any plausible alternative so hard to understand.
So that's the Democrats and how they're going to run, and that's going to be their focus. Do the Republicans pivot at this point and talk about reforming, changing law, or do they still talk about defunding it and getting rid of it?
My suspicion is they're going to continue to use the scare tactics and negative. They've turned the phrase Obamacare, which even Obama has embraced, into a negative. If you ask people, do they like Obamacare? They say no. If you ask them if they like all the provisions of the Health Care Act, they say yes. So the Republicans have a effective political strategy, and I don't know why they would abandon it.
Yeah, they're not going to abandon it.
They may pivot a bit. I mean, listen, Obamacare came back from the dead. This thing was, you know, on life support in October with the botched rollout, and to get to 7 million signups over that is pretty amazing. So you got to give a lot of credit to the president and to the Democratic Party for pushing that. It still is unpopular. You sort of poll and people don't like the concept of it, but they also don't want to repeal it. That is not the majority position. So it's sort of replace is where you're going to see Republicans move. I mean, this outright appeal, repeal, does not necessarily work, and especially doesn't work as the numbers look pretty good. But coming up with a legitimate alternative replacement, which Republicans so far have not done or articulated well, but that could be a winner for them, but I don't think outright appeal works anymore.
We saw an answer to the question of whether Republicans are going to still run with this morning or yesterday in the race for Susan DelBene's seat up near the Canadian border and down through Snohomish County, where her opponent, whose name I forget right now,
Pedro Celis, and others,
sent out a press release on the occasion of hitting the 7 million mark, it seemed like, for Obamacare signups, slamming Obamacare. So it's not going to stop him. He is.
But also interestingly, with the language of replace, there was sort of replace buried in his press release too. So it was a little bit
replace Obamacare, but without a vision articulated.
Yeah. All right. Here,
but not just outright repeal.
All right. Here, I'm gonna do this all in one fell swoop because I still want to ask Luke Burbank a question, which is Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire, moving to Port Townsend in Seattle. Here's my question to you, Luke. I'm pivoting entirely for this pledge drive. I'm teeing you up for a pledge drive promo.
All right.
Mariners lost.
Is this the Kickstarter campaign we're doing to buy more tinfoil for Canute's hat? What are we raising money for?
Public radio. You've heard of it. Okay. I think you've heard of it before. Mariners lost last night, but is the dream still alive?
The dream lives on for these Seattle Mariners, my friend. 18 runs generated in their first two games. Really great pitching. The thing about the season, Steve, is not unlike a pledge drive. It has its ups and it has its downs. But the important thing is to finish strong. So what are we down to, like?
We have $6,295.
Somebody's got to have a Groupon for that. That is doable.
Free massage.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Or if it's from me, $3,000 to not get a massage from me. Whatever it is you want. $6,000 is very doable. I don't know if Tavis Smiley is going to pick
obviously,
up his slack.
Tavis will have to pick.
We got
to
do it now.
Yeah, we should do it now. Tavis is a good guy, but we'd like him to just, do his show, right?
Absolutely, yeah. The Mariners, I know we're almost out of time, but I just want to say the Mariners are a really fun team to watch this year. They have this guy, Robinson Cano, who they spent all this money on, but the guy who hits after him, Justin Smoke,
yes.
The other teams keep intentionally walking wrong, which is the most disrespectful thing you could do to Justin Smoke, and Justin Smoke just keeps hitting home runs when they intentionally walk Robinson Cano. And this is a great chance for the KUOW listeners to hit a real home run for KUOW.
Ooh.
Wow, Luke.
Ooh.
This is why Luke Burbank is on public radio. You are the Justin Smoke of this radio drive.
I'm oftentimes people are trying to intentionally walk other radio hosts to get to me, how little their opinion is of me, and yet every once in a while I will surprise people.
Always, Luke, you're always surprising. That's Luke Burbank. He's the host of LiveWire, which you can hear tonight at 8 o'clock.
Tonight, 8 o'clock.
On KUOW.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Luke.